we live, and then eventually we die, and that's part of the normal cycle.
Welcome to Older Women Live. I'm Rosemary Wally. That was Dr. Golda Tradansky, who's the director of the Palliative Care Unit at Mount Sinai Hospital in Montreal. Golda and I discussed death and the need for quality end-of-life care for everyone. Older Women Live features women's voices from across the globe and revisits over a decade of interviews I've done with a variety of people involved in social justice issues. This series provides background to contemporary issues like age, race, gender, and the impact of globalization on women's lives. In this episode, Golda and I talk about death as a part of life.
Can I start, Golda, by asking you why you think there is this taboo around death?
I think it's a bit of a complicated answer. I think it probably started around the turn of the century when antibiotics were created and we started being able to have people live a little bit longer, sanitation improved, people's infections were cured, and it sort of made it seem like medicine could actually prolong people's lives, maybe even to the point that people could live eternally. We even have people trying to freeze their bodies so that they can be brought back to life in a few centuries. So I think we're pushing life longer. People are living longer. Our whole society is also trying to live longer, live healthier, look better. We keep on pushing away what seems to be our fate. We're trying to push away what the fate is of our humanity, which is we live and then eventually we die. And that's part of the normal cycle. Also, what's happened in the last 100 years is that very gradually, as basically everything that is medicine took over more and more, it took over that part of life as well. And people started dying more and more in hospital rather than dying in their own homes, surrounded by their families and their communities. And so death has been hidden away. It's been hid away into hospitals. People are not used to seeing loved ones die. They think that it just doesn't exist and that medicine will be able to prevent a death, when actually we really are just the way we were 100 years ago, living, breathing, and eventually dying. It's just that we've been able to push that to many decades later compared to people 100 years ago. So very gradually, I think that's how we've gone to fearing death and denying death. Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely. Okay, I was actually going to ask you about the fear. Why are people so afraid of death, though?
Well, people can be afraid of death for many different reasons. They may be very afraid of the suffering that comes before and during death. They may be afraid of what happens to their bodies. If they've seen other people die in what they may have considered to be bad deaths, they may be very afraid the same will happen to them. The loss of autonomy that comes along with getting older and getting sicker, that's fine when you've got your four extremities working well and your head working well, but when you start losing little pieces of yourself, that sense of loss of control definitely is very scary and unacceptable for people. And people, I think, know that this is part of what happens when one gets towards end of life and getting close to death and dying. People can also be afraid of being alone, of being abandoned. And then there's the unknown. What happens after this life? I've seen people who are very religious and feel that religion is giving them strength and a peace of mind, that they will be meeting God after this life, and they feel very peaceful and accept death. And other people, even if they have religion in their life, are actually quite scared of what may happen to them. They're afraid of what sins they may have committed, which may stop them from having a nice afterlife. So the unknown, the questioning that comes around with what happens at the time of death and after death. And there's also fears surrounding what will happen to their loved ones. There's a lot that keeps us wanting to keep on living and not to depart this earth and this life that we've known. I think we need to realize that it is part of normal life cycle, and we do need to think of it as being something natural, and we need to be able to speak to people around us about what it is we would want in various cases should we have a serious illness or an accident. I think that would be helpful for the people who surround us, for our spouses, for our children, to be able to face a stressful situation and take the right decisions according to our own personal values and wishes. Doing the line of work that I'm doing, I think about my own end and what I would want for myself and how I would want to be living my end of life and the things that I feel I need to do now before that eventuality arises. And we never know when that will arise. Enjoy our lives, appreciate what we're doing, appreciate the people around us, and basically live as fully as possible. I think we live more fully when we realize that things do come to an end for ourselves, though life does go on for people around us. And I think in being able to share the joy and the love with our loved ones and enjoying the life that we have, I think that can make the whole difference for people who survive us afterwards.
Is there anything that you can imagine in society at large that can help change this taboo around death?
There's been a huge movement since the 60s with Dame Cicely Saunders, who decided that people who were dying needed just as much care as those who were battling an illness that was potentially curable. And I think as a society, we've realized that palliation of symptoms and taking care of people who are end of life is actually just as important as any other aspects of care to people. And I think that's a movement that started in the 60s and has grown ever since. I have to admit that talking about death and dying certainly is increasing more and more, especially that now in Quebec we're talking about the possibility of euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide. I think it's good that we're able to talk about these things because it brings death out of that realm of it being taboo, and to see what it is that we can do for people who are end of life and how we need to take care of these people. So at least we're able to talk a little bit more.
What do we mean when we talk about a death with dignity?
I think that means a lot of different things to different people. Even the definition of dignity itself, it varies from one individual to another. In palliative care, we consider dignity is to respect the human being that we have in front of us, that we're taking care of. respect that person and that person's social network, their family, consider them as a whole, not just as a disease or as a body part, but think of them as the person they are with the baggage, the experience they have, the entire psychosocial background that they have, and being able to respect that person that we have in front of us, that gives them dignity. And so, yes, people can die with dignity when they are being treated with care and being looked after and respected as the individual that they are. That would be my definition of dying with dignity. I think people may have a different way of looking at it, where they feel that they are maybe should be in control of everything, including in control of their death. I have to admit, we live in a society where we consider less and less people around us and more our own needs and wishes, where autonomy is basically becoming a very important value, and especially our own autonomy, helping people around us, caring after them is a little bit more difficult. And we're not as selfless as we used to be. It's amazing when we see communities having some kind of tragedy, we're always amazed to see how neighbors suddenly are there to help each other. But in most of the time in this society, we tend to think of ourselves first, and wanting things, and when we want them, and when we need them, and wanting them immediately, and having all the services immediately. So with that need to control, I think it's making us as individuals in this society wanting to have more and more control over our lives and our deaths. And that has become the new definition of dying with dignity, being able to control one's death.
I think many of us are afraid of pain. Can you talk a little bit about pain control and the whole attitude towards pain that we have?
I'm quite involved with education and palliative care, so there are so many of my colleagues. And certainly what we're trying to do is get the medical students to understand a little bit better how to use the medications that are out there to help with pain, and to not be fearful of giving pain medications when they are needed. And that needs to continue on spreading, this understanding of how to use medication when it's appropriate to use them, not just to physicians, but also to nurses, to families, family members, because there's still a lot of fear of what the medications in the morphine family can do to people. And we have to dispel a lot of fears and myths around morphine and medications in the opioid family, so that we can make access to good pain control available to everyone. But most patients with pain can have an acceptable control over their pain with the medications out there. I would say over 90% of them. It's quite rare when we have a patient whose pain is not easily controlled. When we have a patient who has a more complex and difficult pain to control, we have interventional anesthetists who can give us a hand and give nerve blocks and spinal anesthesia, so that basically the patient's pain can be soothed via more, I guess we could say, aggressive means if the pain is not controlled. And Another part of the reason why pain may be difficult to control is when patients have a lot of anxiety or depression. And that whole aspect of the morale of that patient will have a huge impact on how that patient will feel their pain. They may have pain, but they may feel it way more if they're suffering at a spiritual, existential, or psychological level. So very often you'll see that in palliative care teams, there's a lot of different healthcare providers, a lot of different professionals that are there to support the patient and the family, but to support the patient with respect to the other types of suffering that they may have other than just pain. So pastoral care workers, psychologists, social workers, even volunteers. We have physiotherapists and occupational therapists and all these different healthcare providers, and they're all there to be able to give assistance to the patient. And it may come in various ways, like music therapists can find ways of soothing and helping a patient relax. Massage therapy can also, just through touch, just be a reassuring presence. So there's a lot that needs to be done besides just giving pain medications. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, most patients can find acceptable levels of pain control. And I'm saying that because we don't try to take away all the pain. We know that when we try to medicate a little bit more, sometimes patients get side effects. So it's always a bit of a balance, but usually we try and find a balance that's acceptable to the patient. We are having more and more hospices opening, but still not enough to take care of everybody. And we know that palliative care is not just for patients with cancer. People die from all kinds of different causes, end-stage cardiac disease, end-stage progressive neurological diseases, liver failure, kidney failure, diabetes, and patients dying, you know, even from respiratory diseases. These people all need good palliative care. Ideally, what we would want is for family physicians and specialists taking care of these people to have at least a bit of a knowledge base in how to take care of their patients' symptoms. Because that way, all people dying from all kinds of diseases would have some kind of palliation. Having palliative care specialists everywhere for everybody is a, you know, also part of utopia. It wouldn't be possible, though it'd be nice to have much more a trained specialist in palliative care. But what we're trying to do is make sure that the new physicians have this knowledge, that doctors who are already practicing have access to continuing medical education in how to palliate patient symptoms. Patients often want to be home. They would like to be able to stay home. And a few years ago, there was funds available to help nurses be trained in palliative care. And nurses who'd go to the patient's home and assess their symptoms and try to bring in whatever devices and other healthcare providers to help maintain that patient at home. Unfortunately, the funds have gone away, and the nurses doing home care, it's CLSC-based, now also have to take care of other patients who may not be as end of life. So we don't have as much training of these nurses happening, and the ones that are doing palliative care have to be doing other things as well. They're being stretched. In fact, our healthcare system is being stretched.
Can I ask you, I can't resist it, you know, what do you think of this doctor-assisted suicide that people are talking about now, the idea of euthanasia?
Yeah. So euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide are not exactly the same thing. Euthanasia is the active act of basically killing somebody with the intention of relieving their suffering, but there's compassion there, of course, but euthanasia is posing an act which will cause the death of the patient. Physician-assisted suicide is where basically a physician will write up a prescription, where the drugs are of lethal doses, and the patient can get that prescription filled out and administer himself or herself these medications to be able to end their lives. As a human being, I have a hard time even killing a fly. I don't see myself going around killing patients. My morals, my values, and that of many of my colleagues are such that we have not come into this profession to go kill people. I feel that it's not a treatment option. It's a cop-out. Certainly, living is never easy. We have to work hard at living. And I think living the end of our lives is also hard work. Not everybody does it well. It's not easy, but that's why there's supposed to be support there for people in place to be able to help them cope with this stage of their life. But killing is not a treatment. It's not a treatment option. And I really don't feel comfortable with the notion that a doctor goes around prescribing and causing people to die. I think that at this point there's a lot of confusion about a lot of the options that patients have and what it means. For instance, withholding treatment or starting a treatment, which may or may not prolong someone's life. That's not called euthanasia, and it's not called physician-assisted suicide. A patient is allowed to decide what treatments they take, even if it means that not taking a treatment, not going through a treatment, may actually shorten their life. Things like giving good analgesia to take care of pain. If it's done correctly, that does not shorten people's lives. In fact, there's research out there that shows that people who take medications in the morphine family may actually live longer, because when you consider that pain is better controlled, they sleep better, they eat better, they have more energy, and they can actually have a better quality, but also maybe even a little bit longer life. So there's confusion about what euthanasia is and what's already available. One thing that we haven't talked about is palliative sedation. And for those people who are suffering and that their symptoms are difficult to control, despite all the best available care, palliative care, anesthesiologists, and interdisciplinary team of healthcare providers to support that patient. If despite all that, the patient is still suffering, there is a way of just making sure that the suffering can be alleviated by giving them medications to help them be more sedated or even basically sleep. And again, that is not called euthanasia, and it's not called physician-assisted suicide. This treatment is usually reserved for people who really are at end of life. And when the patient is sedated to the point that they're sleeping most of the time, they won't be able to drink and eat, they won't be moving around, and certainly complications can arise from this kind of treatment. And those complications may shorten somebody's life. But the real goal of this treatment is really to alleviate the suffering. And like I said, this to me is part of good palliative care. But it doesn't mean that we're actually killing people with these treatments, because again, we've seen through studies that palliative sedation in some cases actually prolongs life. When people have so much anxiety and suffering that when they are awake, their cardiovascular system is pumping even harder, and basically all those stress hormones that they have can actually precipitate other complications. So people who are being sedated palliatively can have, again, more peaceful, controlled symptoms, and the disease takes its course. Some physicians decide to hydrate artificially during this time. That needs to be discussed with the patient if that is something that they wish for. But certainly the goal is to alleviate their suffering. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of my colleagues do not feel comfortable with the idea of euthanasia, nor with the idea of assisted suicide.
But do you think possibly, I mean, I would agree with you that this is not the domain of the medical profession at all. The medical profession is there to heal us, not to kill us. Mm-hmm. But do you feel that maybe professionally assisted suicide has a role in our society, even though it may not be for the medical profession to exercise that role?
That's a hard one. I mean, if I put myself in the shoes of somebody who's having a progressive illness, I can understand that they may be very fearful of a prolonged death, suffering at end of life, or maybe just seeing themselves wither away can be very difficult to look forward to. I think we should have everything made available to support that patient and that patient's family and friends, because suffering is not just of the patient, but also of the people around. I would be scared of seeing people having access to a physician-assisted suicide or assisted suicide from other non-physicians, because I think things could go awry. I think somebody who's got major depression may fall through the cracks and decide, you know, I've got cancer and I don't see a purpose in living anymore, so let me go and get my prescription and kill myself. Or somebody with, you know, who may still have good quality years ahead, who may decide to opt out of life a little bit earlier, without the proper care that needs to be given to that patient. And I keep on wondering, what happens to the survivors, to the patient's family members, the friends, to the healthcare providers who help that patient? Because we know that other countries do have physician-assisted suicide available. In Oregon, in Washington, those states, it's available. I wonder what studies have been done to see what happens to those people. Do their values change? Do they have a burden that they have to live with? Do they become depressed? Mm-hmm. Or does life become basically not as important, not as valued? And it's an easy way out. Mm-hmm. I think that is my fear right now with what's going on here. Yes, not everybody has access to good palliative care. So should we be offering people an easy death by killing them instead? It's way cheaper, I have to tell you. I think there would be less people in hospital beds. There would be less need for resources at home. It's having people be killed is way cheaper for our society than trying to have all the proper care be put in place. I don't understand why as a society, we're not in uproars about this and saying, actually, we should be putting money into taking care our taking care of our sick loved ones who may be at end of life, but whose life still has value and whose suffering needs to be relieved. That is where we should be putting our energies, not in trying to pass a law to kill those people. They, in my opinion, they have a right to be here and a right to be taken care of. So when I read some of what's been written up by the Commission on Dying with Dignity, they say, yes, it's deplorable that there isn't enough palliative care. Therefore, let's choose killing people as an option. Doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You were just listening to Older Women Live, the podcast. On this episode, you heard Dr. Golda Tradonsky. Older Women Live is produced by Michelle Macklin and me, Rosemary Wally. Older Women Live is a production of Aging Communications Technology and CKUT in Montreal, Canada. You can listen to more episodes by subscribing on iTunes or visiting our website at actproject.ca/owl.